Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
I don't know if I'm on air or not, but if I am,
well, good afternoon,
let's
everyone.
Talk about the,
thank you for listening.
What's going on with the Congress?
To my show, Our Constitution.
This, Ryan,
we broadcast every Wednesday.
I don't think Trump should take ownership
live
of this.
Live at 4 o'clock Eastern time.
Because
and
none of the
I encourage you to get your friends and family and
are really in it.
Others
no,
to listen in to what we have to say because
no
we try
transparency,
to cover some important.
There's no buying insurance across state lines. The insurance companies are still getting, or actually, they're getting a bail-in, because if you have 30 million, you know, 30% surcharge on the money that you have to pay into the insurance company, if you don't have insurance, then for all intents and purposes, they're getting some serious cash from people if and when they decide to jump back into the insurance pool. Nothing's changed about this in the scheme of things. The only good thing, in my opinion, is that the mandate is gone. And that actually releases people from having to buy a policy that they can't afford and can't afford to use. That's the only good thing about this. But the thing that's really not talked about, but definitely is a foundational problem, is there are no doctors or patients at the table. Again, I mean, how do you fix this by continuing to use legislative and corporate crony interests to craft a bill that's supposed to work for doctors and patients? It's not about insurance companies. It's not about hospitals. It's about doctors and patients. If we didn't exist, you would not have a healthcare system. Why is it that it's still the same? Well, that's a rhetorical question because I know what the answer is, and I'll ask you, Dave. What do you think the reason is that we haven't changed the model of crafting a legislation that supposedly is patient-centered? What's your opinion on it?
Really shouldn't ask.
I want to know. I bet I know, but go ahead.
Quite frankly, I've about had it. You know, we elected as a country. We sent to Congress, we thought, adults. And, by the way, I like your hair today.
Thank you very much.
I was telling, I'm so frustrated at this point, and you just heard, I just jumped on you for one reason when you walked in the door, but I listen to this stuff, and it's garbage, and yeah. I'm sick and tired of it. It's coming from both sides. They spent today on quote-unquote what we call the news, which is no longer the news. It's my opinion, your opinion, everybody's opinion, but not the news.
Mm-hmm.
They spent all this time on some reporters got Trump's 2005 tax returns.
Illegally.
Big effing deal.
Well, actually, it's actually pretty funny because it blew up in their face.
Yeah.
Because they were expecting him not to have paid taxes, that it would be some, you know, like the typical. It turns out he paid more taxes than, what's it, NBC,
yeah.
Obama, Bernie Sanders. He paid 13%.
But we're,
and
we're,
Romney. I mean, that's amazing.
All this stuff is going on.
It's called,
and,
you know, just confusion, deflection.
Just muddle the waters.
Yeah, well, nothing that they're doing. And I mean, I don't know if you heard this at the, I know we're going off track for a second, but it all counts, fake news. That Hillary Clinton's team is the one who met with a Russian ambassador over and over again before the election. That didn't come on the news at all, but I did hear that, didn't you?
I just heard it go by, and I'm so sick of all of this. When are we?
They're trying.
I don't know.
They're trying to fatigue us.
And with this, the Obamacare and what's going on, I'm beyond words with. With our Congress, they knew what they had to do, and they haven't done it. And Obamacare Lite, or whatever the hell they want to call it now, is garbage.
Listen, you have to keep your eye on the prize. This is Cloward and Piven, where you create such chaos that you either fatigue people or confuse them while nothing changes. You know, ultimately, that's really what's going on. But let's try to distill this down, because this show is not about left or right. It's about the truth. And the people in this has been going on for 8 years now, right? The Republicans have been the supposed opposition. They've passed, or I guess they've written legislation to repeal 1,000 times. If they were really, you know, on the up and up, if they really were about what they said they were, they would have passed the repeal bill that everybody voted for immediately. I'm with Rand Paul on this one. You all agreed to a repeal. Just vote for it. That would decimate this octopus called a health insurance plan. I'm listening to, I found another podcast, Dan Bongino. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's used to be Secret Service. Now he has his own radio show. And he's very astute. He was talking about Congress and how they craft things and the rhetoric from the left and the right. It's amazing how they are both going towards the same goal, but the rhetoric is different. So the CBO, let's jump around for a second. CBO report came out and said that it was going to be, 14 million people were going to lose coverage? But in actuality, that's what the Democrats are crowing about. People are going to die. Oh, my God, it's the worst thing. But what it does, what you really read into it, what you should read into it, which is the truth, is people are so unhappy with Obamacare. They can't afford it. Those are the people who are going to leave it when they are unleashed or released from this mandate. And that's the only good thing about the Ryan bill, once again. That means they're unhappy, and they can't afford it, as opposed to, oh, it's awesome and they're being kicked off against their will. No, there's no mandate, which means you're deciding to leave it because it's way too expensive. And, I mean, there's so many thoughts out there that make sense.
Well, it's down to these stupid exchanges that we heard about.
They don't work. There's like, five left?
And
they don't work.
Yeah, and what? How many insurance companies are left?
Only five.
There's only five out of the...
This whole thing is based on monopoly.
I didn't even think there were that many left.
They tried to go down to three, but Aetna and Humana didn't work out, and Cigna and Blue Cross didn't work out, thank God, because that would have been... I'd have been down to maybe one insurance covering that I would take at that point. But nothing's... That's... You know, you just said the magic word. The insurance companies, the infrastructure of the payment structure of our healthcare system is messed up. It has been usurped by corporate interests who their only goal is to get money. These aren't altruistic, okay? They don't care if you're covered for your cancer. Get over it. The insurance companies have these earthy, crunchy, awesome commercials, how they love you. They love your money. They don't want to pay it. As soon as you end up needing it, they find some excuse not to pay it. So let's go back to that, the CBO thing, right? Complete lie. It's all based on emotion. This is the worst thing ever. It's going to, you know, it's a Simon Legree of healthcare plans, this Ryan Care, which sucks. I'm not going to say it's good. But that's not the reason that 14 million people are leaving. But they neglect to say, you don't have universal coverage under Obamacare. Thank God. Number two, more than half of the people who got on Obamacare got thrown off the insurers they actually liked and had to buy that. And they were living in fear of being taxed, so they were stuck on it. This is a shell game that they're trying to produce. So forget the Democrats for a second, because they're going to lie about anything just to make themselves relevant, when in actuality, their plan has hurt more people than helped. I'm not going to say it didn't help everybody. There are people that it helped, but you know what? They went on Medicaid and they got covered. That's not Obamacare, that's Medicaid. They just expanded who was eligible, and there you go. This is not much better. Under Obamacare, the millennials were on the hook for paying. Now it's going to be the seniors, because they're going to have to pay five times more in premium. Their premiums are going to cost five times more than a young person. Well, what if you're a senior who's really healthy? You're just going to get nailed with a five times more?
Yeah.
Why don't they just have a risk pool, for God's sake? And how come you can't pay more if you have medical conditions? That's fair. If you have 1,000 medical conditions, one, you should probably be on Medicaid or Medicare. But let's say you're making it. You should pay more. If you smoke, you should pay more. If you have hobbies that are dangerous, you should pay more, just like you do for life insurance policies, you know. That's fair, but they're trying to you know, what do you call, share the wealth, redistribute the wealth, but their system is based on something that could never work. On this last podcast, he had Gruber, quotes from Gruber, you know, the architect, saying that if we told people, and I'm paraphrasing, that they would be taxed for their health insurance, it never would have gotten passed as a law. If we told people that healthy people were going to have to pay for sick people, this never would have gotten through. We had to lie to do it, and I'm glad we did it. How clear can that possibly be? So now this new Ryan Care thing is going the opposite way. The young, healthy people aren't paying. The older people are paying. But it's one size fits all.
And the older people, though, have already paid.
Of course they have. And they're paying for Medicare, but they're going to pay for the private side. They're double paying, essentially. Yeah. And it doesn't do anything for price transparency. And I know we probably have to take a break in a minute, but before we take a break, let's just finish this thought. The problem with our healthcare industry is that it's based on artificial costs. We are paying more if we carry an insurance card than if we're paying cash out of pocket. There is nobody talking about that. Nobody. And that's why the insurance rates are so high. That's why when you walk into an ER and you use your insurance card and you're paying these crazy deductibles, the insurance company aren't paying very much anymore. They keep saying that they are, but the deductible, the average is what, $2,500? $6,500?
Oh, you don't have to tell me a whole lot about any of this right now.
So what are they paying? Maybe some people with some serious diseases, but trust and believe, I bet you they're pre-certified and not covered to death. Want to make a bet on that one?
and a quick thing, we do have about a minute, but in a quick thing, let me ask, okay, and I've tried this. God knows I've tried this. But let me give you a thought. You bring your car to me to have it washed, or before you bring your car to me to have it washed, you say, David, how much are you going to charge me to wash my car and vacuum out the interior? And I say, well, Dr. George, I really don't know, because I haven't seen how. You might have a lot of mud on it. You might have stains on your carpet. And it just really depends on what it looks like when I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, David, don't you wash cars every day? Well, sure I do. But that doesn't mean, you know, your car might be bigger than the car I just washed. They can give you every runaround, and, you know, my God, if you take out a set of tonsils every day, you should damn well know approximately what it's going. I never wanted the exact figure down to the pennies, but just give me, you know, within reason.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get this out of anybody anymore, or certainly not the folks I've had to deal with in the recent past.
That's by design. If you can't tell the price, you can make it up after the fact.
Exactly.
I can be in an hour in a case versus 2 hours versus 3 hours. I still get to charge the same amount. It doesn't change by complication, by anything else. It's just this, it's a flat rate. Why can't they do it? And, you know, the hospitals own the machines. All right, it's not like they're buying them. Like an office, you know, a doctor's office, you're going to lease something, you're going to pay on time, whatever. These hospitals can pay out of pocket and get it done and own it and make the return on investment probably in about 3 or 4 patients on average. When does it stop? When do the pharmaceutical companies make their money back and then they can drop the price? When does that happen? On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. As you can imagine, in the last week, I've done a ton of interviews on this. And everybody that I've talked to, when you start talking about consumer-driven healthcare, they get it. So what is consumer-driven healthcare? It's simple. Price transparency is the only way, really, that we'll be able to drop the prices in our society. Because you'll be able to compare apples to apples. And if anybody really knows that it costs 100 times more to do something in a hospital than it does in a freestanding independent concern, whether that be a lab, radiology center, surgery center, doctor's office, people would just, their mouths would hang open, and they do. And I give them the example of having a patient pay $2,500 for a tonsillectomy, which includes everything, my fee, OR fee, anesthesia, to the time you're discharged, versus $9,500 in a hospital for the same thing. People are like, what's, you know, are you kidding me? Or CT, $250 as an out in a freestanding radiology center versus anywhere from $800 to $2,500 in a hospital for the same test. There is no excuse for that. None. And the hospitals have done a bang-up job of getting rid of the competition.
Oh, yes and no. Yes and no.
Yes and no?
Yes and no.
Okay, well, what do you mean?
The no side of it?
Yeah.
Do you want me to name names?
Mm.
Northside Hospital, okay? So you can go to Northside Hospital or Emory and get a MRI or MRA and get shafted. Or you can go to Northside Imaging. Well, Northside Imaging, they're on the north side, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can go there and get screwed by the same hospital because they bought out
the independent
facility.
I know. There's only one left in Atlanta.
And it's like you said, a damn shell game. It's like, you know, how do you trace them down? How do you, you know, and they charge just as much. Well, wait a second. I can get the same. Well, you know, we're owned by, they'll finally admit.
I know. I remember because I used to send people who didn't have insurance or high deductibles to them, and it was a fraction. It was that count,
now,
you know, that amount of money.
At the same damn time, you can't get a CON, as they call it, certificate of need, to put in a facility because the hospital has such a lobbying and...
Stranglehold is what you call it.
Yeah.
This has been, I think it's starting to reverse a little bit. I don't know about Georgia, but, I mean, the damage has been done. It'll take years to actually, you know, have enough independent surgery centers to be really competitive. You know, there's like one or two left in our city. But the certificate of need, for those who don't know, is the, I guess, a dispensation by the government that you're allowed to have a surgery center that is independent, privately owned, not owned by a hospital.
Our hospital.
Well, that's, the price structure is different.
Yeah.
So we're talking about people who are not associated with a hospital, not on staff, not connected. That's competition. If the hospital owns some of it, that's not, because the hospital's got its fingers in the pie. And what they did over the course of about maybe 10 years in Atlanta, and I'm sure it's rubber stamped all over the country, is first they did it by legislation. So they said, oh, poor us, we can't compete because it's not fair. So they stopped giving out certificate of needs. So that means you had a finite number of competitors and no new ones could pop up. Then they went about buying them out. And it was like, I used to belong to like five different areas to operate. I'm down to two because they bought out all of the surgery centers. Everyone I went to eventually got bought out by the hospital. Done. Doctors who did have a stake in some of them, those are gone. Hospital took it over. And the prices went up. I mean, so again, $2,500, and this is just an example. Like, you can do it in GYN, ophthalmology, every single specialty is the same story. Something that's reasonable and affordable to something that's outrageous. And then you look at the trend, you look at the movement of payment towards the patient, we call cost shifting. It went from just carrying an insurance card and everything covered under a copay, which was nominal, $10, $25. First they went from $10 to $25 to $50 to $75 to, you know, $150. Then they went to co-insurance, so $80-$20, $70-$30. Now it's deductibles. So before, again, you had nothing. Now you're talking about, and I've only seen maybe one or two, $500 out of pocket. Those are gone for the most part. More likely it's going to be $2,500 for an individual, $6,500, $7,500 for a family. And when you get really crazy or you have someone who's self-employed, it's $10,000 deductible.
And then that only brings you up to the 20% level. It doesn't totally do away with the
It depends on your policy.
Yeah.
So first of all, you're on the hook for that entire amount. So let's say you have a, let's go nice, $1,500 policy. You have to pay $1,500 out of pocket before it kicks in. You're right. Depends on the plan, right? So $1,500 will get you to the point that they pay 80-20. Then you probably have another $5,000, up to $5,000 before they pay 100%. So they get you coming and going. Meanwhile, you're paying a premium every month. You're rarely using your the average person goes to the doctor maybe twice a year. That means you put in $14,000, $20,000. You just gave it to them. No rollover. No reward for being healthy. You just keep paying that over and over. Who rigged that system? It's amazing. And it wasn't like that initially.
No. But so what choice do you have when you could be easily faced by an astronomical bill from the hospital or from, you know, so yeah, what choice do you have but to keep...
Well, let's say you didn't want to do medical cost sharing. Why don't you just buy a supplemental policy like Aflac or MetLife or whatever? We have Aflac, right? So
no, they won't give it to me because I'm over age.
I'm surprised about that, actually.
No, I've checked in. You and I talked about it a couple of years ago.
That's wild. So if you were, I don't know, I'll have to ask my...
65.
Let's say you carried the plan, you had it before you were 65. They wouldn't kick you off once you hit 65. I have to find that out. But let's just, for argument's sake, you're able to buy that plan. That would cover you for heart attack, stroke, cancer, any of those big ticket items. You get a $250,000 check written to you. You would get covered. You get money back for being in the hospital. That's something that takes the edge off for people that can use it, and that would get you out of buying these crazy insurance policies, because ultimately, just because you have health insurance doesn't mean you're going to get the care. That's what nobody talks about. They make it seem as if it's a panacea, that once you buy your premium, once they subsidize your premium, everything's awesome. It's not. If you need subsidies to afford your premium, how on earth can you afford $2,500 deductible? Or $5,000, or sending. You're not using it. What kind of person thinks that's really the end all be all? The people are like, oh, it's against poor people. Poor people can't use it. They're still on the hook for the deductible. And God forbid they get it well to the government or the people who love this stuff. God forbid they do better the next year and they have two jobs that they're working. They're going to take their money back. Their subsidy comes back in their taxes. It's not a gift. It comes back. So this is a complete shell game on all fronts that's designed to make you pay for something to make a corporate interest money. And it works against you. And the people up there in Capitol Hill refuse. I digress. Because there's this Nancy Pelosi asked for people to tweet her their experiences under the Affordable Care Act. It was hilarious. I'm sure she turned her Twitter off. I have so much money, I have to do two jobs, thanks for nothing. I mean, it was just like a list of people who couldn't afford, and the deductibles were crazy, and they couldn't afford their premiums. Maybe, I hope she heard that and actually read the thing. I don't know. But your thing didn't work. The only way it's going to work is if you get rid of the obscene cost drivers in the system that have nothing to do with doctors. 7 cents of the healthcare dollar is going to the doctor. Where is the other 93 cents going? That's what you need to be legislating, and they don't. They just make that more powerful.
The other thing that I've promoted with our show, Doctors for Patient Care, and I say promoted or asked the question of, and I have zero input with Congress, obviously, but it comes down, and you were talking about it early on in the show, my health compared to your health, compared to Joe's health, compared to an 18-year-old's health. You know, we got to get away from this painting everybody with the same brush.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't do it, and insurance can't do it. It's gotta come down to an individual basis. I think the other thing is that you talk about transparency. I talk about capitalism, that it's got to be a free market. If I want to buy insurance from Alabama, power to me. If I want to buy it from New York, power to me. If an insurance salesman walks in my door right now and has a better deal than what I got, I should be able to change over without any
choice.
You know,
you're right, because what works for you won't work for me.
Exactly.
And vice versa. And it allows a system to remain in place that doesn't work for patients.
This is the way it was 20 years ago, approximately. 20, maybe 30, well, no, longer than that, I'm sorry. 40 years ago. But, and you didn't cut your finger and go running to the insurance company and say, how much are you going to pay to get my finger sewed up? You went in and got it sewed up and paid your $100 or whatever.
As soon as capitation, the whole thing really went to hell in about 1997, 98, when the HMO capitation thing came online.
Yeah.
When they started controlling the first dollar of healthcare, from the time you walked into the doctor's office to the time you left, that was the beginning of the end. Whoever holds the purse strings has the power. It used to be the patient, and that's when you had a consumer. I'm going to shop, and it wasn't all that expensive, one, because the doctor was a one-to-one. The doctor and the patient did not have a middleman. The price was lower because you didn't need an administration infrastructure. Look at the hospitals, right? There are 16 administrators to one doctor as a ratio. What are all those people doing? Collecting a check, making it hard for the doctor to be a doctor, making sure that the paperwork's in place to get as much money as they possibly can from the insurance companies, from Medicare and Medicaid. They don't provide a service. They're not taking care of patients. They're working against patients for the most part.
Hey, you know, the stupidest statement that I've continually, well, we have to charge us because we only get paid that.
That's ridiculous. First of all, yeah. What's the value of what you do? Is a Tylenol worth 2 cents or $20? You are jacking up every single thing as a line item. That's why I tell everybody, if you're going to the hospital, get your bill itemized and make them do that and make sure everything they told you that they did. They didn't duplicate it. They didn't put things on your bill that you never had. You have to protect yourself as a consumer. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We have such interesting conversations during the break. This whole system is designed, as I said before the break, to make money. How do you do that? If you are a business person and you're trying to maximize profit and make more money and get bigger and make sure you have no competition, how would you go about doing that? The first thing I would do is change my workforce. Get rid of the most expensive aspects of it. You know, whittle that down. Get less, sophisticated labor to be the front line of care, and that means technicians. It's gone on throughout the entire healthcare sphere. You've got pharmacy techs. You've got nursing techs. You've got physician assistants are, I think, a higher level of care, but they're still not doctors, and they're the front line of care. They don't cost as much as a physician. The training time to get it done is less than training to be a physician. And the knowledge base is different. So you have people who are taught to work within the grid of an algorithm. Even the medical students are at this point, and I'm hoping Dr. Amerling, I'm going to have to get him on at some other point, because I want to talk about medical education again. Now that he's in a different country, what is the difference that he's finding between his training of those students versus the ones he used to train when he taught in New York? But from what I've seen, they become social justice warriors. I spoke for Benjamin Rush Institute maybe about a month ago, and the students that came to that were, you know, libertarian, entrepreneurial-minded, and they were all like pariah in their respective medical schools. They couldn't speak freely. They were, you know, treated like they were dirt because they wanted to take care of patients and have a business mindset as well. There's nothing wrong with making money. If you provide a service that's valuable, you should be paid for it. Why does that change if you're a doctor compared to anybody else? And again, I've gone through the evolution of feeling badly, you know, like someone calling and saying, well, you drive a nice car, you don't deserve to do. Yes, I do. I work over 100 hours a week. I trained over 6 years to be an ENT, and I work for my money, and I work when everybody else is asleep. How dare you? You don't set my value. I do. And if I decide I want to charge something for a service, then I'm going to do it, and you don't have to come and see me. And that's my attitude now.
You know, Dr. George, I don't know who has done it. Maybe it's the government. Maybe it's insurance. I don't know. But we have been taught as a society to accept.
True.
I don't accept. Oh, do I ever catch hell from my wife? Because I don't accept. We had an incident yesterday that she called in a lunch order. I was standing there when she called it in. She wanted hers on pumpernickel. I wanted mine on whole wheat toast sandwiches that we were ordering. We both got our order on white bread.
That happens a lot.
That was not really good white bread from a place that touts to be gourmet sandwiches. You know, I embarrassed her, I guess, but I called the place back and said, you know, two out of two, we didn't get what we ordered. Now, you know, we've got, as a society, I won't accept. And as a society, we shouldn't accept. If I'm paying for a doctor, I should get a doctor. If I'm paying for a nurse, I should get a nurse.
Well, you should have a choice. And you should decide, hey, I want to pay you less for a nurse practitioner or physician assistant, or I want the full, you know.
Exactly. That's a very good point, yes.
That should be the patient's choice. And some people want telemedicine. That's awesome. If you want someone to take a picture of your mole and tell you what it is, then you should have that. But to have a one-size-fits-all charge you through the nose for substandard, you know, it's substandard care. Walking into an ER, not having a doctor see you, maybe getting a diagnosis, but not treatment, is what the standard of care is now. So they'll come in with an abscess or some sort of tonsillitis. Maybe they'll get treated, but more likely they'll get a referral to go see your doctor. They don't even treat people, but they're charging you for that. Or my favorite.
A lot.
$600,000 just to walk in the door and get no care. You didn't even get a prescription. At least that should come with it, right? If you're in a rural area, it's even worse. They're going to stick your butt in an ambulance, send you to another hospital, another, you know, center hospital has got the required people in it to cover an emergency room, but they're going to charge you for that ER visit that they didn't do anything, and the ambulance ride, and they're going to charge you for the same assessment when you get to the new hospital. So this is a system that's based on inefficiency, even though they claim it's efficient. And this is how the hospitals got away with all this nonsense. We want to be bigger because we're going to be more efficient. We're going to lower the costs. We're going to provide better care. Well, they aren't doing that because, one, if you're in a satellite, you've got to be bused in or shipped in or ambulanced in to the center. That's not efficient. They have so many 16-to-1 administrators, right? You're going to have to go to the lower rung. I mean, you've got the, even the house staff, right? The, I forget what you call it, the, oh my gosh, the doctors who are...
Hospitalists?
Thank you so much. That didn't exist when I was a resident. We were the hospitalists. And if we had an issue, the attending came in. So you actually got your doctor coming in to take care of you, not some one rung above an indentured servant, taking care of 100 patients every night. You don't know who the hell they are. You have a list to, you know, down to your knee with, like, just a to-do list of labs you need to order, you know, stats you need to check, just to tie that person over to the next morning. So that the next doctor can come in and take over. But the doctor who admits the patient, or the patient who is the, you know, the patient's doctor proper, has no say on what's going on. Why don't we take a break? You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. This is the beauty of having a live show. My guest today is Dr. Richard Amerling, and as you know, he's been a guest before, one of my favorite people. And of course, because we have different countries that we're dealing with now, we get a little bit of a snafu, but he's here, and I actually wanted to get his impression. Now that you're practicing or teaching, it's in Grenada, correct, the medical school?
Yes.
You're outside of this whole mess going on in the United States with Ryan Care and the CBO. So as an observer at this point, what's your take on Ryan Care? Is it an improvement on the Affordable Care Act, or is it a joke?
I think it's just a marginal improvement. It's just nibbling around the edges. The major features of centralized care and third-party care remain.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a totally dysfunctional and wasteful system. And I'm not surprised. I mean, my take on this is that, look, there is probably $3 trillion a year being spent in the United States on care. And of that, doctors may get maybe 15 or 20%, you know, big maximum.
Mm-hmm.
Who's getting all the rest of that money? I mean, those are the vested interests that are writing these bills. The insurance industry, hospital industry, drug industry, everybody is reaping billions and billions of dollars, of healthcare dollars, and none of these people has the slightest interest in changing the status quo, and neither do they have any interest in controlling costs, because that's where the money is. That's where the money is coming from. It's all this massive overspending.
Mm-hmm.
You know as well as I do, if we went to a system that we used to have where patients paid out of pocket for their routine expenses and then had catastrophic insurance like you do for everything else in life, we would be spending far less. Patients would become very careful shoppers. They would go to the doctor when they have real problems and not imaginary problems. And we would order far fewer tests. We would prescribe far fewer drugs. They would want to be interested in taking better care of themselves in the first place. The health of the nation would improve greatly, and total spending on healthcare would mm-hmm. go way, way down. So the people who are making all of these trillions of dollars don't want this to happen. And by the way, that does include some of our colleagues who depend on a flow of patients who are not really asking that many questions about, do I really need to see you that often, or mm-hmm. do I really need to have this procedure? You know, mm-hmm. they like that passive market of third-party payment-receiving patients to keep their gravy trains going. So virtually everybody in the system except patients is getting a lot of money out of it, and they don't want to change it.
I think the patients also need to bear responsibility, because they don't want to be consumers. They just want to be told what to do. I mean, I would question, I would really question why I have to pay so much for a lab or a radiology study and ask, is there another way? Or if I pay cash, will I get a discount? All sorts of things that patients can do to take their power back, they actually don't. I mean, but maybe they don't know. And that's part of the problem. But if it's dysfunctional, I would think you'd be looking at all sorts of things to try to work around the system. But the only good thing I can see in the RhinCare bill is there's no more mandate. Well, actually, the president already got rid of that because it was an executive order that people weren't going to be fined or taxed. And that, to me, maybe people are so unhappy now, maybe they'll start to go outside of the box and look at other things. And that would drive, to me, you need patients to be in this system. You need doctors to play the game. And if a growing number of doctors and patients take a different route, would you think that would work to make the legislative process catch up to us?
Well, I don't know. I've more or less lost faith in the legislative process to make any real change. I think the change is going to have to come from patients and doctors. Mm-hmm. Patients are going to have to start to take responsibility for their own care and their own decisions, and doctors are going to have to opt out and provide care outside of this straitjacket known as third-party payment, which is increasingly dictating how you practice.
Agreed.
Through payment for performance and that sort of thing, where they're going to be scored and paid based on how often they prescribe statins, which are toxic drugs that do extremely little, and other miracle cures that aren't, mm-hmm. but which are mandated from the payers because someone put the word in, someone put the fix in, and all of a sudden that becomes the standard of care, and if you don't do it, you're going to get penalized.
That's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? That their standard of care is making you, in some instances, prescribe medications for people who otherwise may not need it. So, I mean, we talked before, I know, about widening the net so the parameters change on what's considered pre-hypertensive, pre-diabetic. Now you're supposed to take a medication in prevention. These are all things that actually cost the system more money, patients more morbidity, and ends up not helping really anybody, but you're right, the cartel, the medical cartel that stands to gain.
Exactly right. I mean, type 2 diabetes in the majority of patients is not just treatable, but curable mm-hmm. with a low-carb, high-fat diet.
You never hear that.
And weight loss. So if patients were actually paying for their care, they would be very interested in actually being cured as opposed to being managed with insulin and greater numbers of drugs throughout their entire life. I mean, this whole concept of chronic disease management mm-hmm. is in a way bizarre, and it's relatively new in medical history. And most patients with type 2 diabetes and, I would say, hypertension are treatable without drugs and actually curable.
Mm. This much money goes into that. And then the people who have kidney damage because of the medications they're on ending up on dialysis and God knows what else, right?
Oh, well, look, if you trace it back to the original sin, it was the low-fat diet, the low-fat diet which ended up with the food pyramid and high mm-hmm. carb intake mm-hmm. and massive amounts of sugar intake, and sugar, of course, was always the culprit in terms of the increasing incidence of coronary artery disease back in the 50s and 60s. But Ansel Keys pushed and pushed, and the result of that was the low-fat diet, which was extraordinarily unhealthy. It was a massive change in the public eating pattern, pushed by every level of government and advisory group, embraced by the food industry, giving us low-fat this, low-fat that, mm-hmm. which, of course, all was fortified with sugar to mm-hmm. make it palatable. Mm-hmm. And the obesity epidemic and the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and coronary artery disease and kidney disease that followed that was all a direct result of this centrally mandated diet, which was a total, total disaster. I mean, untold millions have suffered and died as a result of this. That's how bad it is.
That's amazing. So you're talking about the food industry as well, but what about just what they're feeding the animals themselves? I mean, I noticed, there's this switch to corn and all sorts of GMO stuff. Does that also, in your opinion, affect our health?
I haven't really looked at that very carefully, I must say. All I can tell you is that I eat my eggs every day. And I think that, that keeps me healthy. My weight is under control, totally. I mean, I'm not hungry. I eat bacon and eggs every morning. Mm-hmm. And I really don't eat anything after that until dinner. I mean, just I run off of that. And I think that if people start to embrace that kind of diet, and I'm doing my best to push it on, through social media and any outlet that I can find, people will get healthy again. And again, that will also dramatically lower spending on healthcare. But of course, no one is really interested in that except doctors and patients.
No, it's you're absolutely right. Even the medical societies with this the standard of care, that evidence-based medicine, there's always a medicine attached to this, I noticed. Nothing tends to be natural, nothing supplements, you know, that you can fix the problem. It's always something to put a Band-Aid on it and just control it. I believe that if the pharmaceutical industry could do whatever they wanted, everybody in this world would be on something once a day for the rest of their life. I really believe that.
Well, yes. It's this whole concept of treating numbers, going after numerical targets as a substitute for a healthy patient.
Yeah.
So if your numbers are all good, you must be healthy. No matter that taking statins is going to make your muscles ache and God knows what else, and is going to lower your cholesterol. Well, so what? So what? I mean, I just read a review of the major statin studies showing that they really do not improve mortality. They really do not. And the side effects, such as the muscle issue, the increased incidence of diabetes from statins, is brushed under the rugs.
Do they increase your risk of stroke or heart attack?
Well, there are those who suggest, and I think this is plausible, that statins are responsible, partially at least, for the increased incidence of heart failure that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years. Because why should we have more heart failure if we're curing coronary artery disease with statins?
Good point.
The answer to me is that because it's a muscle toxin, causes coenzyme Q depletion and mitochondrial dysfunction, that it's affecting that big muscle known as the heart and just weakening it over time.
You know, we have to come back so we can talk about this as a show in itself, because I want people to really understand, and I always considered medications as a controlled poison, really. I mean, there's dose ranges for a reason. Not everybody will respond the same way. And you're right, not everybody needs to be on something. I mean, you have people with BMIs, for example, of 30, but they're really healthy. I mean, it fits them, their blood pressure is normal, everything else is great. Why are you forcing people into numbers when we're not all the same?
Right. Well, that has been a triumph of this evidence-based medicine movement, which has been hijacked by industry, so that only their studies pass muster.
Exactly.
Legitimate EBM, whereas clinical experience is relegated to the lowest possible level of the hierarchy of evidence.
And that's
and
exactly.
if that were true, then why have any experience? I mean, then in that case, then an intern is going to be as good or better than somebody, a clinician with 30 years of experience.
No, I never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. And that gives me a really good segue in the time we have left to what is going on now that you've had some time and gotten your feet wet out in Grenada. What's the difference that you're seeing between the medical students you're teaching there with the ones that you've trained in the States?
Not much, really. They're a wonderful group. I mean, I can't say enough good things about them. They're dedicated, they're motivated, they're smart. I think that they're fabulous, and I'm just hoping to give them a little nudge towards what I call scientific medicine, which is using the basic sciences and deductive reasoning as your major motor for your decision making, as opposed to relying on guidelines and so-called evidence-based medicine. I'm hoping that they will start to think for themselves and challenge the orthodoxy and do things that are physiologically intelligent as opposed to mandated by some august body making a pronouncement, which is all opinion anyway.
That's true.
So I'm hoping to give them a little nudge in the right direction. To me, it's the crowning moment in my career to be able to really teach a large number of medical students in this way, because they're the future. They mm-hmm. really are the future of medicine, and these young people will all go out and develop practices and affect the lives of perhaps millions of patients going forward. So to me, it is really an honor to be there, and I take it very, very seriously. You know, they really deserve the best.
You know, I was talking to my producer before you came on about, I had an opportunity to talk to kids who are members of the Benjamin Rush Institute, and their experience with their medical student colleagues were, you know, that they were somehow bad because they wanted to be entrepreneurs, because they wanted to not go along with the social justice warrior mentality that seems to be, it's kind of linked to the education system. I don't care if it's undergrad, graduate, now it's gone into the medical school side of it. Are you seeing any of that?
I haven't. I'm sure it's there. And of course, the a lot of the professoriate feel that way. You know, I just read this article by Ovik Roy, who I'm sure you know, in the Wall Street Journal, talking about Medicaid, and he's one of the authorities on the disaster known as Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a little response to this piece in the Wall Street Journal, and it has to do with the way the program was set up. It was set up in a very altruistic but misguided way to help the poor, but they decided from the outset that they would pay doctors very low rates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in New York, it's a $30 payment to see a patient, an office visit. You'd have to see 10 an hour to make even a minimal amount of money to keep your office afloat. And that's just not going to be good medicine, no matter how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Medicaid patients were, from the outset, denied access to the top-tier private physicians and ended up in clinics and in hospital emergency rooms where their care was fragmented, not great quality, and very expensive. So this misguided notion that by paying doctors less, you're going to get better care is at the core of what has happened to the medical profession and to medicine in the United States. Everybody's trying to balance the healthcare budget on the backs of the practicing physicians, who are actually the most efficient and necessary element of the system in terms of cost control. If you had just paid those doctors Medicare rates at the time to take care of Medicaid patients, every one of the Medicaid patients would have picked up a private physician. It would have happened in a week. They would all be snapped up, right? Because that's the way it works.
Yeah.
And they would suddenly be getting good quality, regular office care, and they would say goodbye to the hospital emergency room. They would almost never go back to an emergency room. They would not need to. And they would have immediately saved a ton of money. But again, the people who are really making money off Medicaid are the hospitals, the nursing homes, the drug companies, the transportation companies. All this stuff is paid for very generously by Medicaid. So they're the ones who are pushing to maintain Medicaid in its current form. And the patients be damned. I mean, Avik has research showing that the Medicaid patients do worse off than patients who are uninsured. You know,
that's a tragedy.
Quite incredible.
It is incredible. You know, with that, I'm gonna leave it here, because that's like a teaser that you have to come back and we have to discuss this in more detail, because those,
you bet,
what you just said is a show in itself, and people really need to understand that, so we can stop falling into, you want people to die, you hate poor people. It's actually the opposite. We love our patients. We want to take care of, no matter who you are, what you look like, we want to give you our best, and we're being stopped from doing that. So
that's right.
Thank you so much for coming on. Even though it was short,
Elena,
it was sweet.
So sorry about that.
No, let's talk.
We'll make it up.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, great.
And
take care.
You too. And thank you
bye
for
bye.
Listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.